Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Tuesday, June 23rd, 1998. In the fireside room this evening is Joel Mugg. Today's session number is 98-1, and it's titled Breaking Cocoons, the Quest for Global Justice Through Transformative Education. Let's listen in.
I think we'll begin. Let me begin by just introducing myself. My name is Joel Muggy. For the last 26 years, I've worked at Augsburg College in Minneapolis. In the last 16 of those, I was either the director or co-director of the Center for Global Education. I've just left that position as of the end of May, and currently a consultant in the areas of intercultural communication, organizational development, leadership, and philanthropy, and I also sell real estate part-time. So it's an interesting shift in a career for me. However, I think the series that I'm going to be sharing with you this week really focuses and evolves out of the work that I've been doing the last 16 years in global education. And this series is really a focus on global justice. And the series tonight, we're going to focus on transformational education, the kind of education I think that, sort of exploring what kind of education leads to an understanding of global justice and maybe helps to create a commitment to global justice. Then on Thursday morning, I think, I'm going to be focusing on a particular theological response that I think has been strongly linked to global justice, and that's liberation theology. In our work at the center over the last many years, one of the very important dynamics that we've explored with our folks has been the kind of the theology that emerges from the ground up, so to speak. Theology that emerges and is developed and created among the very poorest in our society. And then on our third session on Friday evening, we'll focus a little more specifically on the particular, what shall I say, benefits of travel education as a way of both doing education and creating an awareness of global issues. Just to give you a context for the things I'm going to be sharing tonight, I want to say a word about the work of the Center for Global Education. Basically, the center has been involved for many years in doing education with both traditional academic students and adults through a process of immersion in cultures around the world. And I'll say much more about that on Friday night. But it's basically, if some of you were at Larry Rasmussen's session yesterday morning, Larry talked about that some people in the world have benefited more by modernity than others. And generally in the kind of education we do, the teachers in this kind of education are those who have not benefited so much from modernity. And I think that'll be become evident as we begin.
What's modernity?
Modernity.
You mean technology and things
like that? Yeah, I think all of that sort of thing. Technology, everything that's kind of what we seem to be, most of our society seem to be grasping for. Let me begin. What I want to begin with is to lay sort of a foundation of the kind of educational philosophy that undergirds what has come to be known as transformational education. And much of the underpinnings of this kind of education have their roots in the work of a Brazilian educator named Paulo Freire. Now, how many of you have heard of Paulo Freire? Okay, that's usually about the number of people who raise their hands. I think what's very interesting about that is that in many parts of the world, Paulo Freire's name is very well known in education circles, but in this country it's not. And I think there's some reasons for that, because of the challenges that Freire presents to our whole system of education. So I'm going to spend a few minutes tonight talking about Freire, and then I'm going to have you do a couple things to kind of reflect some on your own education. And we'll also have a time to raise some questions. Paulo Freire was born in Brazil, and he did his work among the poorest peasants and urban shanty town dwellers in Brazil. And his initial work was in the area of literacy training. He was teaching people how to read and write, but he had a very unique approach to that, which said that what you have to begin with is people's reality. You can't just come in and start talking about, teaching the alphabet and teaching how to people read and write. What you do is you begin, come into a community, you have people meet together and talk about their problems and talk about their situation. And then using their own situation, you begin to teach them how to read and write using the words that emerge out of their situation as critical words. Okay? For example, maybe a community lives on the edges of a garbage dump, which is common. Some very poor communities throughout Latin America live on the edges of garbage dumps. And the people have a sense that the garbage may be a part of their health problems in the community. So you begin talking about health and what are the problems in the community, and very soon people begin to say, well, it's the basura, the garbage. Basura is actually a Spanish word. I don't know what the word is in Portuguese. I think it's probably similar. As they begin to talk about how does the garbage contribute to their problems, and how do we begin to work to empower ourselves to deal with this problem, then the learning of that word takes on a new importance to people. And so you begin with that word, and that's where they begin to read and write. And you may, put up the syllables of that word, and you use that as what Freire calls a generative theme. It's a theme that's emerged out of the community. And so this notion that issues emerge out of the community is a very central one for Freire. Freire suggests that there are two kinds of people in the world. There are subjects and objects. Okay? Subjects and objects. Subjects are people who are constantly in the process of reflecting and acting on their world to transform it. They're always acting to transform the world in which they live. Objects are people who are merely acted upon, who do not participate in the recreation of the world. They're people who are willing to let the world sort of do it to them, right? To kind of, they don't want to rock the boat, they want to just fit in and follow the process and not question or challenge the direction of the world. And subjects, on the other hand, are those who think and act critically about their role in society. Now, furthermore, Freire says, there are oppressors and there are those who are oppressed. Oppressive people or actions are those which prevent people from reaching their full human potential, right? I mean, they keep people down. They keep people from reaching their potential. And the oppressor's motto, if there were one, is something like, to be is to have, right? To be is to have. And this having can consist of wealth, but it can also consist of power, control over others, possessions. The essential element is the oppressor's identity is totally dependent on having, okay, on having something. Now, Freire also talks about humanization and dehumanization. For Freire, humanization is the process by which people all become, realize their full potential. And it's a state we never reach but are always working toward. And dehumanization, simply stated, prevents people from doing that. Oppressors, for Freire, are agents of dehumanization, and the oppressed, in his terms, are the results of that action. On the other hand, humanization, or as Freire would also say, liberation from oppression, is or ought to be our vocation as members of the human community. And Freire would also say, because he was strongly rooted in the Catholic Church in Brazil, as Christians, that ought to be our vocation, liberation from oppression. It's a task to which we are called not only as members of the church, but as members of the human community. Now, how does this happen? I cannot free myself, nor can liberation be given to me by somebody else. I cannot free you, you cannot free me. Real liberation or humanization takes place, for Freire, when people dialogue together and critically act and reflect upon their world with one another in order to transform it. So there is this concept of dialogue. When people are working together and dialoguing, reflecting on their world in order to transform it. So you'll see in Freire this very important emphasis on community. This process of acting and reflecting, sort of action and then reflecting on the action in, on the world, is what Freire calls conscientization, or conscientizing, I can never say it in English, but it's the process of becoming conscious of the reality in the world, opening one's eyes and ears to the world the way it is. And it's people learning to perceive the social, political, and economic contradictions in the world and then working to try to change them. Now, this process of action and reflection, and we're always going to come back to that, this notion of action, reflection, and I hope if nothing else you come out of this session understanding this concept, is for Freire, what Freire calls real education. And he says most of what we're accustomed to, especially in the West, and especially in the United States, but in the West in general, is not education at all. Most of it is dehumanizing, because most of it, he says, is teaching us how to be. It's not opening, but it's closing us. It's channeling us rather than opening us. Freire suggests that much of Western education has adopted what he calls a banking approach to education. The teacher is the source of all knowledge and then deposits that information in these empty deposit boxes, which are the students, right? And so you just pour it in. And I think we can all think back on our own education and think, who were the teachers who really helped us to think creatively? But on the other hand, who were the teachers that we knew if we kind of fed it back the way, you know, we were taught, that would get us a good grade or whatever it would get us, right? This notion that that the teacher is the actor and the student is acted upon. And it's basically sharing information about the way the world is, right? It's depositing information in people. And Freire says this kind of education deadens critical thinking. The assumption is that students are empty receptacles, incapable of creative thinking, and they're not actors in the world working to recreate it, but puppets learning to imitate what they've been told. Where unjust structures are present in a society, it serves to indoctrinate, teaching the student to adapt to reality rather than to challenge or question it. That makes sense to you? Mm-hmm. That this whole process preserves unjust structures. Oppressive societies must preserve this banking kind of education so that people will not develop the ability to think critically and act critically and somehow then be able to transform society. Now, liberation education, on the other hand, sees everyone as student and teacher at the same time. And so you can imagine this, even that statement starts to, for most of our academics, especially institutions of higher learning, even that statement becomes a little threatening, right? And all students, teachers and students, everyone is both student and teacher. All have something to give and something to receive. Freire refers to teacher learners and learner teachers. So he does distinguish that there is a role for a teacher and a role for a student, but that unless this is a process of engagement where all are learning from each other, then we really don't have true education. And the most important element is really empowering people to reflect critically, again, and then to act to transform the world rather than information sharing about the way the world is. All right? So this notion of critical thinking is very, very important for Freire. And what I'm going to talk about a little bit later this evening is basically what I call some principles of critical consciousness. What does it mean to help us and to help students, to help anyone in the process to think critically? This kind of education that Freire is talking about happens when people begin to dialogue with each other. And for Freire, dialogue has some very specific kind of components to it. It really, for Freire, dialogue is comprised of five dimensions. It's found in profound love for people and for the world. So love is a very important dimension for dialogue. It requires humility. I cannot be in dialogue with the world and with those around me unless if I am arrogant. And so it's a position of humility with respect to my co-learners and with respect to the world around me. Third, it requires faith. Faith in people believing it is every person's desire to become more fully human. So it's a kind of a faith in human, in people's sort of quest for humanization. Fourth, it needs hope. It is fruitful to be involved in dialogue if nothing will come of it, if you don't think anything will come of it. So there has to be hope that the world can be transformed, it can change. And finally, again, we come back to this theme, it involves critical thinking and action, whereby people work together with one another in order to transform their world so it is more human. So this notion of action and reflection again. Now, at the work that we've been doing at the Center for Global Education, we have to keep in mind that Freire's theories developed, again, in working with the poorest of the poor, right? Where he began to see that the poor can be the agents of their own change. Nobody was going to change their situation for them. They had to become the agents of their change. And Freire's work has had a tremendous impact in Latin America, and especially within the church. And we'll talk more about that on Thursday when we talk about liberation theology, because liberation theology really also has its roots in the work of Freire, because of this notion of forming learning communities at the grassroots, and those communities really are the ones that began the process of liberation theology. But what does it mean for us in North America to begin to use Freire's approaches? And especially in a situation where I've been working the last many years, in which the primary people that we're working with are middle class or upper middle class North American, both students and adults. How do we apply Freire's principles to that kind of learning environment? And so while I think it's important to say that Freire's work has been very important to us, it's unfair to say that we've been using a Freirean method. Rather, what we've tried to do is take Freire's concepts and to apply them in our own context, and then try to understand the implications of his work for our context. Okay, now, I want to stop here for a moment because I've been doing probably a fair job of what Freire is talking about, and that is banking education. I've just been feeding you a bunch of information here, right? And to the extent that I get nods and, there's some dialogue, but not very much, right? So what I want to do is I want to move this into a more dialogical situation here before we move on. And I want you to reflect for a moment. You may want to jot down a couple notes to yourself because I'm going to ask you to share this with somebody next to you in just a few minutes here. I want you to remember. Think back in your own life and remember a powerful learning experience in your life. And if you want, if you want to say the most powerful learning experience, that's fine. But I want you to think back on a powerful learning experience in your life. It could have been part of your formal education or not, but it was an experience that made a difference in your life. It somehow made you more aware of perhaps of social problems, or more able to be a part of the solution of those problems. So I want you to think about that for a moment, and think about a profound learning experience in your own life. I'll give you just a minute to, and do some serious some reflection on it. What were the components of it? What was it about? And I'm going to ask you to share that in a bit with some others. Okay, get yourself in groups of three, preferably people that you don't know too well. So if you turn around and kind of get a little cluster going. It's all right, if you can't, you don't have to move all over the room to do it, but just... If it's two or four, don't worry about it too much. Okay. Now, what I'd like you to do is I'd like you to simply share that experience with the other people. Talk about it a little bit. What about it was so important for you? What were some of the components of that learning experience? Just share that experience. I'm going to give you about 7 minutes to talk about it. So you can't spend all day on it.
Very different.
This way. Now, what I'd like to hear from you, I don't want to hear about each of these experiences. You shared them among yourselves, and that's great. But I'd like to hear from you, what were some of the characteristics of those experiences, either yours or what you were hearing from each other? What were some of the characteristics that you heard? Describe the characteristics of what you heard.
It wasn't, well, what it wasn't was a classroom.
Okay. How many of you, your experiences were in the context of, not necessarily a classroom, but in the context of your formal education? Four. Now, I think that's great for the four of you. The tragedy is that all of you didn't raise your hand, right? Why is so little of those critical learning experiences, why are so few of them taking place in our formal education?
It'd be interesting. Were any of them from listening to a sermon?
Yeah. How many?
Any?
I didn't ask that question. All right, what were some of the other characteristics?
The other question that can go along with the classroom is, were they all positive?
Yeah, okay, that's another one. How many would say they were positive experiences?
Oh, yeah. The classroom, mine was classroom, but it was not a positive
experience. Not a positive experience. Good point. What are some other characteristics?
Experiential.
Okay, it was experiential. Okay.
What was learned came as a surprise.
All right, good. Others?
Happened in community, not in a vacuum.
Okay. Oh, come on now, folks.
Through peer explanations.
Through each other.
Yes.
Okay, so it's somewhat in community in a sense, right?
Peer community.
There wasn't necessarily a teacher doing the... Yeah.
Joel, all of ours were outside of our normal life or experience or typical context.
Okay. I'll put normal in quotes. How's that? Context. Okay. Any other characteristics? It would help if I numbered correctly, wouldn't it? Okay, any other characteristics of the things that you talked about?
They tended to be challenging in the sense that they weren't all positive, as in all happening
okay.
while they were happening. But
yeah,
I mean,
okay, so they had an element of challenge to them, some of them, which might have been uncomfortable. At times, could have been some of them. How many of them had a cross-cultural component to them? Raise your hands. Okay, fair number had a cross-cultural component. Any other characteristics that stand out for you? Okay, well, what I'm going to do is share with you some of what we've come to call principles for critical consciousness that have emerged out of our work in education over the last 2 years. And I want to see if you can recognize some of these principles in, or some of these characteristics in the principles that I'm talking about, and I think you will. And try to sort of apply these, see how your own experience might have been a reflection of some of these principles. And as I said, these are principles that have really emerged for us. We didn't start out with, well, this is what we're going to accomplish with this kind of education. It's just sort of as we've been doing it in the kind of the Freirean style, what has emerged is we're seeing these are the kind of things that seem to make a difference for people. The first thing that I think we've discovered that education for critical consciousness is something that education for critical consciousness is not. All right, it is not simply the learning of new information, or the insertion of new courses or new components or something into the curriculum. You know, those of us in educational institutions, we're forever revising the general education requirements and forever revising the curriculum. I think what we find is that that's not transformative education. Hopefully, it would be nice if that would get us closer to that. But education for critical consciousness is not just learning new information. It may involve some of that, but it's not limited to that. Secondly, this kind of pedagogical approach must involve learning from. Learning particularly from those whose voices have been least heard in recorded history. That doesn't mean... We realized about 10 years ago, we used to use the term, we're learning from the voiceless. And we said, wait a minute. That suggests these people don't have a voice. The problem is that people don't have a voice. The problem is that people haven't listened to them. And so learning must take place, it involves learning from those whose voices have been least heard in recorded history. That means women, the economically poor, in this country, people of color, and we could go on down the list, right? That those whose voices have not been listened to and not been heard are the ones that ought to have a priority as we decide who we're going to listen to. Thirdly, and related to this, people in dominant sectors of society must learn to see ourselves, our history, our cultural norms, and the world from the perspective of those who are different from us, politically, economically, and culturally. And particularly, again, from the perspective of the poor who constitute the majority of the world's people. And for those of us who are men, that means learning from the perspective of women. For those of us who are straight, learning from the perspective of gay and lesbian people. For those of us who are white, learning from the perspective of people of color, and on and on and on, right? It means we have to recognize the power and the intensity of our own biases, of our own cultural myths or ideologies. It's education that must help us to see and to confront the ideological captivity of place and time. For many of us in this room here, that place and time is sort of middle class North Americanness, right? Our ideology is our basic, often unconscious or unspoken set of assumptions about the world internalized by growing up in our particular society. We all have those biases. Now, I like the term cultural myths because they provide the framework for which we initially deal with any new information that comes in. We have a set of assumptions about the world, and any information that comes in, we process them through those. And the dominant ideologies of our society mask some realities in order to preserve the status quo. And the problem is that many of these assumptions are false. Now, let me try to give you an example, a very concrete one. During the early part of this decade, when the world was, quote, celebrating in various forms the quincentenary of Columbus' arrival in this hemisphere, at the Center for Global Education, we did a number of trips that were focused on trying to break through the cultural myths that surrounded Columbus' arrival. And so we did trips especially to Guatemala, looking at the impact of indigenous communities on what the conquest meant and so forth. And so, and I think you all remember the kind of hoopla that was going on about that. And what we're trying to do is challenge that very fundamental cultural myth that many of us have raised with, that somehow the advent of European society and European culture in this continent was a altogether positive force, right? And I think many of us here recognize the contradictions in that. But at the same time, all of our education ought to be questioning those kinds of assumptions. Okay? So breaking through cultural myths. Does a particular educational approach help us to break through cultural myths? What are some of those other myths that sometimes go unchallenged in our educational system? Anybody want to share some of those? And that we might want to think about ought to be broken through?
America is a peace-loving nation.
Okay.
Indians are savage.
Mm-hmm.
Technology is always good.
Yeah, okay.
In God we trust.
Everybody hear that?
Yeah.
In God we trust.
I think, you know, if we were to do an analysis of that, we'd come through with so many kind of assumptions about the world that are sort of unconscious to us, and yet that in a real open education process need to be challenged if we are really going to have...
I have the original ad. It won the national award and ran for about 2 years, and it summed up the, quote, Protestant work ethic,
what
was really the Protestant ethic. And it was Safeway, and some of you may remember it if you're shoppers like I am. It was, you work an honest day, you get an honest deal at Safeway.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, and the original ad has the sun, which is a picture of salvation. And it has all the people facing the sun. And the only person that's not facing the sun is the minority person who's looking back. Don't ask me why. But it was the whole logic of opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's opportunity, work hard, take it, and then the end justifies. The reward is justified. If you make $100,000, you worked hard, you took the opportunity, amen. And the system's blessed.
And the reason that ad works
loved it
is because people believe that's the way the world is, right? Our whole society has trained us to say, you work hard, you will get ahead. To move under that myth becomes very difficult sometimes. And so part of our educational system, I think, our educational approach has to be bringing people into contact with those for whom that myth is not a reality, right? And to understand why it isn't. And to begin to challenge that at its fundamental level. And in a sense, what we're saying here, and this is my next point, if education is to create critical consciousness, it must present realities that cause cognitive dissonance. That awareness of deep contradictions between those assumptions and the new awareness, or a new understanding, or the reality, a contradiction between that assumption and the reality. One of the biggest ways, and this has happened in our programs, it has to do with this very theme, that people who can't get ahead is because they don't work hard. And many of times our travel programs will visit places like the townships in South Africa or peasant communities in Latin America. And we'll be in peasant communities or even living with families and suddenly discover how hard these people work. You know, getting up in the morning, maybe working all day in a sugarcane field for $2 a day, you know, the most backbreaking work there is, and then coming home and barely having enough for tortillas and maybe some beans, but usually just tortillas. That, for those people who have learned that you work hard and you get ahead, that experience creates tremendous cognitive dissonance. You follow me? It doesn't fit. And so something has to happen internally. That means some change has to take place in how we put things together in our understanding. And for us, simply creating occasions where the voices of the underside, if you will, or those whose voices aren't heard, and where those people are treated with the same respect and dignity in that learning process as meeting with a university professor, even the president of a country. Just doing that creates cognitive dissonance. I know we've been we've had programs where the same group met with the president of a country and met with peasants, and those people were treated with the same as equally important voices, right? How much of our educational process really does that? Fifth point, and this one you've said, many of you are seeing, you've hinted at here as well, but this one is very much directly related to some of what you said. The notion that learning that really challenges assumptions and ideology happens most effectively in community, and more specifically in a non-judgmental community. Without a kind of trusting community where people can share their fears and their anger at this kind of, because sometimes it sparks a lot of anger, right? And where people are free to express their ideas, even though it may be contrary to what others in the group are feeling, right? And being able to express feelings of grief and fear as fundamental assumptions become challenged. Community is essential for this kind of learning to take place. And so that community building has to be a central component of the educational process. In other words, you can't just expect community to happen, right? But that skill at building community, in my mind, is one of an educator's most important roles. How do you help build a community? We've also alluded to this in the past. Essential to critical consciousness is the action component. That is, acting on new understandings. Our tremendous tendency is to grasp and understand. It's just like when I'm trying to lose weight. I mean, I can understand it, I get the concept, I'm committed to it, and then I have to do it, right? It's tougher to do it. The same is true, I think, in this area. The tendency is to grasp and comprehend, but not change our behavior. How do we act on these new learnings once they've happened? The acting part is always the most costly in terms of time, energy, money, and so forth. And it's having the tenacity, the courage, and the ability to challenge and to confront and to uncover the dominant ideology and to act out of sync with the norm. Having the courage to do that once this new learning takes place is often difficult. And again, to come back to the need for community. If you're going to end up acting out of sync with the norm, challenging fundamental assumptions that everybody around you has had and lived with all their lives, you need a community for support, right? That's essential. Just a couple more, and then I want to open it up to you here. It also, in this educational process, attention must be paid to the affective dimension. Because the content is often loaded and very painful and can challenge core values, some emotional responses can be intense. And for some, the drive to ignore or deny these feelings is very strong. And often, how many haven't you heard educators say that emotional reactions really cloud reality and they're a barrier to learning? We have to be objective, right? The old argument about objectivity. I'm suggesting that emotional reactions can actually help to focus learning if we build upon those reactions when they occur. And that means we must be able to adjust what we're doing to respond to those reactions. We can't sort of follow through with the agenda or the program that we had planned. Now, is that if this is manipulating people. You get them all worked up. You have an emotional reaction to something, and then you use that to sort of tell it like it's supposed to be, because they're very vulnerable at that point. And I think there's a risk here. I think it requires a great deal of responsibility on the part of an educator. The key is not to take advantage of people's vulnerability when it happens by imposing an explanation, but rather help people struggle with their own responses. Really help them honestly and openly struggle and not impose some kind of solution on them. I think we have to honor the inseparable relationship between personal transformation and societal transformation. I think we must trust that experiences which touch the heart, that is, the more subjective experiences, if you will, are a legitimate and necessary part of a holistic educational process. Finally, and then I want to open up to your discussion. Well, two last points. The second to the last is that learners' personal stories, I think, and cultural history must be acknowledged. We must, in whatever process, draw out people's personal stories, because that is an important dimension of the learning process. As we begin to understand our own history and our own culture, that's the only way we can really begin to honestly engage with someone else in that process. And finally, education, I think, and for me, this is the most important point of anything I've said tonight. Education for critical social consciousness operates with the assumption that the best kind of learning is learning how to learn. In other words, if the most important thing to be learned in all this, and if I've been involved in some kind of educational process, if what's happened is that the person has somehow become more open to a process of change within him or herself and in the world, then I think it has become a successful educational experience. So that what we're doing is opening people to a constant process of learning. The learning is not something you just do and then you do less and less of it as you get older, but you do more and more of it, and that you're constantly opening yourself up to see the world in new ways, rather than, as so much of our educational process does, keeps us getting us focused more and more and more and more. And I think it's one of the challenges of why we've found that sort of utilizing or trying to create avenues for this kind of education within academia is perhaps the most challenging of all. Because those of us who have been trained in academia have been trained how? To become more and more of an expert on a smaller and smaller, smaller piece of reality, right? Secondly, we've been trained not to work or learn in community, but to be the expert, right? And it's a very individual kind of approach to learning. So that has been another dynamic that, as we try to begin to open academia to a new approach to learning, we're dealing with those kind of assumptions and values and sets of training. So I think it's a very challenging thing. I think we see much more of this happening in some respects within grade schools, elementary schools, a more open process to learning, and I think beginning to happen at other levels of education. But still a very big challenge. Let me stop there and just open this up to any reactions you have to anything I've said or you've said tonight.
Well, I think there might be a similar risk in the model you're describing as in traditional education. And it seems to me that risk is in gathering in community
because of the way we structure our communities. Like-minded individuals mm-hmm. tend to gather together. I'm guessing that we're all fairly like-minded individuals, so we'll have a tendency of moving together in a particular direction. It would seem to me that in terms of encouraging diverse point of views, it might be reasonable to attempt to assemble individuals with different points of view, because I would like to hear people who, you know, would like to defend, you know, rampant use of the wilderness. I'd like to
right.
hear what they have to say, and I'd like to say things back to them.
I think you're absolutely right. I found the most exciting learning experiences for me. Let me jump back. When we were first doing the work we were doing, much of it was in Central America during the 80s, and many people came on these educational experiences. We're fairly like-minded, you know, sort of against the Contra War, you know, blah, 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 right? Well, one of the things we found ourselves as a staff doing at that time, there was a tendency towards a kind of a groupthink, and that we find, even though most of us as staff, you know, had similar sorts of feelings, we really challenged ourselves to say, if we're going to create this kind of educational experience, we got to be challenging some of this as well, the tendency to groupthink, and to really be creating opportunities for people to hear a wide variety of points of view and challenging the kind of simplistic thinking that might lead to certain conclusions, right? I think what we found in recent years, as the issues have maybe had less clarity and we've broadened the places we've gone, that we've had in our programs much greater diversity of perspective. And I think that creates a much richer experience. As you begin, but even in a situation where you're creating this kind of, trying to create this sort of environment, a classroom, there you don't, you know, you're going to have diversity. And to really still try to create community in the midst of that, then I think you're absolutely right. It becomes a much richer exchange.
Yeah. I think the difficulty is that it's often not a safe community, and people right. get tired of personal attacks if you're right. trying to present a point of view, and then instead of talking about the issue, it turns to personal attacks about your naivety or your mm-hmm. misunderstanding of the world, rather than trying to debate or dialogue the ideas. And so I think in a community of diverse opinions, it takes practice. It takes practice in the classroom with students
right.
to respect others, and we need to do that with students in the classroom, is foster that as an investigation and a respect for everyone's opinion and a respect for everyone to speak. I mean, you practice at doing it.
Right. I think that's absolutely right. And I think that's partly why I said this, the notion of community formation is such an important aspect of an educator's role, I think. How do you help people do precisely what you're talking about? And it does take a lot of practice. Other comments or thoughts?
Interesting thing. I'm involved with Catholic worker movement too. Yes. Notre Dame and a couple of other universities right now are going to create a chair of Catholic worker theology. Yeah. And the Catholic worker movement is just objecting like everything. They say the minute you institutionalize what we're about, you kill the very thing.
Yeah.
That you don't learn at the university, you learn out on the soup line or at the protest side or with the aid patient or out on the street, whatever it is.
That's right. One of the real contradictions in this too, when you're doing this in the context of a formal education that we've lived with, and it has to do with this institutionalization, one of the things that we've run is a number of academic programs abroad using this sort of approach. And then you get to have the point you have to grade people. You know, and so all of a sudden you know, how do you put a grade on this kind of learning, right? And yet the institution demands it. And I mean, that's a significant challenge as well. I have time for one or two more comments, and then I want to close with just a brief reflection.
You can't do that. Okay.
Any other comments?
You have to grade their improvement and open.
Yeah, grade how open they've become, right?
Sometimes I think if you use Prairie's asset banking image, you have to get bankrupt sometimes before the transformation can do anything.
Yeah.
And I don't mean that in a financial way or anything, but in the sense of how do you get, as an addicted person, I know what that means. If you're not, you may not know what it means. But I think in theology it's clear, from we're all beggars. And if I don't see myself as a beggar, and that you're the only one that needs something,
right,
then I'm going to try to fill you up with something. And we have a whole social system, the whole mentality. And my wife gets paid good money to do that, so I'm cautious sometimes. But I think the bankruptcy is necessary, and that's not a negative. I think the people I've learned and most from are those who have failed, literally, in the job. How do you grade Juan down in? So you don't grade them. You grade the student instead of, but we already made the judgment about them.
That's right. And one of the interesting dynamics that we've found is on the first day or two of a trip, there's always this tendency of people from North America to quickly come up with solutions.
Yeah.
You know, this is what these people need, right? Usually by the end of the trip, that's not quite so clear anymore. And it's a part of that, sort of becoming, instead of the ones who have something to give, recognizing what they don't have, that maybe somebody else has to give them. And but that dynamic, I think those of you who have had this kind of experience, you know, those first couple of days, everybody's got so many people have answers to what's going to solve those people's problems, rather than reflecting on who I am and where I might need to change. Let me close with something between a prayer and a reflection. That was written by a participant on one of our travel seminars many years ago. And I think captures a little bit of the transformational quality of, and both what some of you were talking about, the it's not always pleasant, it's often a challenge, but captures, I think, the transformational quality of what I've been trying to talk about tonight. We are back now, the 23 of us, newly born again to life, to struggle and to pain we never knew before. Led into life by those who live daily with death. Fed by the hungry, who took our white hands, uncalloused, into theirs, dry and gnarled and brown. They took us in, the strangers, into barren huts with shy smiles they shared their sparse lives. Don't, we beg you, ask us if we had a good time. It was painful, stabbing. The ache will burn within us, haunting our safe American dreams. For they, the lost of the earth, have found us, moved us to reality, and in the finding, perhaps, just perhaps, have saved us. Thank you very much.